Observers of the current presidential campaign have cited the prevalence of fear among primary and caucus voters. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll discuss one of the elements causing that fear, the potential of a terrorist attack on U.S. soil. My guest Peter Bergen, author of The United States of Jihad, argues there's more potential danger from a domestic terrorist than from an immigrant or refugee. Also, real estate continues to be big business in Arizona, but where can the average person find accurate information about values and trends? The Arizona Republic says it has developed something new that'll provide that. It's called Street Scout. I'll ask Republic real estate reporter and columnist Catherine Rieger about that. Plus, 20 years ago, Roger Klein and his band The Refreshments hit it big, jumping from the Valley scene to a major record contract. I'll look and listen back with Klein to some of the impact songs from Fizzy Fuzzy, Big and Buzzy. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. We start today's program with a look back at last night's presidential primary results and how they could impact Arizona's presidential preference election next Tuesday. In a few minutes, we'll talk about Hillary Clinton's successful Tuesday night. Now, though, to the Republicans. Governor John Kasich was able to win his home state of Ohio, but Donald Trump continued to roll on in some other states, including Florida. That win led to Marco Rubio dropping out of the race, leaving only Kasich, Trump, and Ted Cruz on the Republican side. What does it all mean with Arizona's primary only 6 days away? I ask Jaime Molera, a partner with the Molera Alvarez Group. Jaime, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
So, Jaime, how significant is John Kasich's win in Ohio, and how significant is it that Marco Rubio has dropped out?
Well, I think it's very significant for Donald Trump in that he beat Marco Rubio in Florida, and he beat him decisively. And it seems as though Trump is continuing to win in a very impressive manner, which makes it very difficult for those that would like to see and believe that there needs to be another Republican candidate. And this whole talk of a brokered convention at some point, it makes it difficult because he keeps winning in fairly significant margins. It was a good night for Kasich in that he stays in the race. I think he will need to really come up fast in order to have any kind of momentum to stop Trump. But right now, it doesn't look like it.
And now, a lot of early ballots have been turned in by Arizona primary voters already at this point. Do you think a lot of those people, I mean, it's hard to gauge the percentage, obviously, but was Marco Rubio gaining any momentum in Arizona? Are those votes going to end up being, to some degree or other, wasted?
Well, that's a good question. I didn't see Marco Rubio gaining a lot of momentum in Arizona, and I think that was played out where he didn't get any momentum even in his home state, so it's hard to predict that he'd have a lot of momentum here. Everything that I've seen shows that it looks like it would be another good night for Trump in Arizona. It's a winner-take-all state, so that makes it even more important. He continues to rack up the delegates, and I think it's something that a lot of national watchers would look at Arizona as saying, okay, if he can win in a state like Arizona, conservative, and he wins big, it just adds another layer to why Trump may be inevitable.
Now, Trump has gotten public support from Sheriff Joe Arpaio, former Governor Brewer, also former State Senate President Russell Pierce. For a lot of people in Arizona, certainly when it comes to the sheriff and Russell Pierce,
sure,
there are very mixed feelings, maybe not even mixed, very negative feelings toward a couple of those. But the fact that Trump has attracted them, what does that say to you about his Arizona support? What does that say to you about his stand on immigration?
Well, I think it would continue to be a big red flag for a lot of people that believe, particularly with Latino vote, that believe that Latinos will have an impact in this election, or minorities in general will have a big impact. Mitt Romney didn't do very well with Latinos, and that played very well for President Obama. The same scenario could play out, but this election has turned everything on its head. You see a lot of disenfranchised, I think, what used to be Reagan Democrats, blue-collar union, that seems to be resonating well, and it's interesting how that might play out. Well, he might lose a lot of the Latino vote and certainly the minority vote. Will he be able to capitalize on people's anxiousness with immigration, with terrorism, with all these things that are out there that are leading him to get more and more of that blue-collar vote?
When George W. Bush was running the first time, and even when he won re-election, a lot of critics would say about him, there were a lot of sort of bumper sticker phrases, but at the same time, people actually thought he actually thought about some of these issues and had some depth on some of them. With Donald Trump, it does appear, at least when he gives speeches, there's a lot of, I'll take care of that, I'll take care of that, and there are no specifics. Should that worry Republican voters at this point?
Absolutely, and I think that's why you see a lot of the Republican for lack of a better word, establishment, worried about that. I think if they believe that that kind of rhetoric that really doesn't match with what Republicans are normally supported and the issue that Republicans normally, free trade, for instance, has been the mainstay of a lot of Republican philosophy for since Reagan. But Trump has been a proponent of trade wars, and especially with China, and saying that we need is more of a nationalistic approach. So it's interesting how that reconciles with a lot of Republicans that are running on those platforms that are different than Donald Trump.
Now, Trump is coming back to Phoenix. It's been confirmed next Saturday, Jaime. What does that say to you? Anything significant about that?
Well, it shows that, once again, that he's believes that he could win Arizona, win it big. And if he does win Arizona and win it big, I think it goes back to that argument. It would be very difficult for Republicans to deny him the nomination if he has the clear mandate of voters. Whether or not there really are people that believe in Republican philosophy or not, he still has been able to capture that sentiment that people just want to see a change, regardless of what the change might be. And I think it's makes it difficult for Republicans to challenge that.
I mean, finally, we often talk about civility, especially on this station. And when you see the success of Donald Trump, to some people that indicates that a lot of voters don't really care about civility. Are we reading too much into that?
No, I think that's a very good question. I think it goes back to this, and people are starting to really analyze what's been going on in the last few years. There's a lot of anxiousness. A lot of people are worried about the economy, worried about the national scene, worried about terrorism. And they have somebody in Trump that's giving voice to their anxiousness. And whether or not his policies will be successful at the end of the day, it really is resonating with people. And to your point earlier, he's not giving concrete answers on how to deal with them, but he's giving a very strong voice of folks. They're feeling very nervous about what's going on. And it's, at least for right now, it's catching on.
And very briefly, do you see him being having the usual sort of Republican strength in a potential general election in Arizona, or does this give Hillary Clinton more of a chance?
Well, I think it does give Hillary Clinton more of a chance, mainly because if she can dominate the minority vote, which looks likely that she's able to do. But again, I think the Clintons need to be very worried about whether or not those union blue-collar voters that traditionally will vote more to the Democrats, it might catch on with a Trump candidacy, particularly because he's talking about things that are not so much Republican. He's talking about things that go to the heart of a lot of union members' angst about whether or not they're losing their jobs to other countries. That could be very powerful. And so I think they're going to need to take care that they just can't use the same playbook that has allowed the Democrats to win these last two elections. They need to be very thoughtful because, let's face it, the Republicans weren't able to change the playbook and what they thought would be Trump leaving the stage 6 months ago. And so they need to really think through that.
Jaime Molera, partner at the Molera Alvarez Group. Jaime, thanks as always.
Steve, it was a pleasure as always.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Now to survey what's happening on the Democratic side, I'm joined by Mario Diaz, president of Mario E. Diaz and Associates. Mario, first, give me your reaction to how well Hillary Clinton did last night. And is this, for all intents and purposes, at least for the nomination, sort of knocked Bernie Sanders out?
Well, Hillary outdid herself last night, winning all five of the contests. There's still some are maybe too close to call, but for all intents and purposes, she was victorious. And really, Separation Tuesday became that, putting a distance between herself and the Sanders campaign.
So based on the response that Bernie Sanders got yesterday, speaking last night at the Phoenix Convention Center, how popular is he in Arizona? How popular is Hillary Clinton? Do you expect her to win pretty handily next week?
Well, in Arizona, I think if you look at the historical campaign for Senator Sanders, he has been turning out quite a large crowd during his rallies, but those numbers have not translated into victories necessarily. You know, he had large crowds in the states that he visited where there were elections last night and did not win one. So there's not a correlation there.
Does Hillary Clinton, though, have to pay attention to the passion of some, at least the followers of Bernie Sanders, many cases younger voters? Is she going to have to try to, in some ways, please very young people, please Generation X, and also please baby boomers. I mean, that can be a challenge to get all those. I guess it's nice to have the opportunity to try, though.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right, Steve. And she has been paying attention to that particular crowd. If you look at some of the exit polling numbers from last night, there's still some work to be done in that 18 to 35 year old category. And I think all credit to Senator Sanders. I think Secretary Clinton has been paying attention, and there are more of his issues that are coming from her that Sanders has been talking about. They're coming from the Clinton campaign now.
Now, on the Republican side, Mario, it's been confirmed now as of this morning that Donald Trump is, in fact, going to hold an event in Phoenix on Saturday, presumably, obviously, aiming to win Arizona on Tuesday and keep building his momentum. How important do you think that is in terms of what it says about the importance of Arizona to him and how popular he may be here?
Well, I think given the early ballots had gone out almost 25 days ago, this election may be over for Trump already. He is immensely popular, Trump is, here in Arizona. And this visit on Saturday, I'm sure, is going to be an interesting one to see if there's going to be any counteractivity against his presence. But make no doubt, Trump is just about ready to close the deal on this nomination. And it just perplexes me how Cruz continues to talk about him being the alternative when there aren't that many delegates out there to catch up.
Well, as a Democrat, Mario, are you pleased that the likely nominee, Hillary Clinton, will face probably either Trump or Cruz? I mean, does that make you feel good about your chances?
Well, it makes me feel good because this is what democracy is all about. The overall picture of democracy is having choice, and there is no better opportunity for a voter to have, quite frankly, extremes on many issues between a Hillary Clinton campaign and a Donald Trump campaign.
I want to come back to what you said about the early ballots, because that's fascinating, and I'm not sure we pay enough attention to that, this idea that early ballots have been out for about 3 weeks, a little more than that, and so in many cases, this could already be decided. How dramatically can that affect the strategy of the candidates?
Well, it's a 30-day election now. As I've said before, it's no longer just election day. It's a 30-day election. And rest assured, the voters in Arizona, I've been paying attention to the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks on the Republican side and on the Democrat side. And, you know, they've had much to learn from about these candidates, even though there really hasn't been much resources spent here in the state for either of those two candidates.
One thing Donald Trump has said is that he has brought the discussion of immigration reform or illegal immigration or border security more to the forefront. Now, in Arizona, we've been talking about it constantly for a number of years, so maybe it's not quite
Correct.
The same. But how big an issue do you think that could be with people who have not yet voted in the presidential preference election, both on the Democratic and Republican side?
Well, it's going to be a big issue for the Trump supporters, and it's going to be a big issue for the Hillary supporters, because quite frankly, the more that Donald Trump talks about immigration, not in a responsible manner, not in a comprehensive immigration manner, but more on a law enforcement matter, more of Hillary Clinton's voters are going to be passionate about her campaign.
And Mario, finally, this has not been a great state for Democrats as it relates to the general presidential election, but based on the fact that Bill Clinton won Arizona and based on the fact that Republicans are not quite sure necessarily, some people are not sure about Donald Trump, do you think Hillary Clinton would have a good chance of winning Arizona in the general?
There are so many moderate Republicans, as a Janet Napolitano campaign demonstrated a few years back, that will cross over when given an opportunity before to have a moderate candidate versus a more extreme candidate. Moderate Republicans will cross that line. And yes, there is therefore an opportunity for Clinton to win Arizona in November.
Mario Diaz is president of Mario E. Diaz and Associates. We've been talking about last night's results and what's to come in Arizona. Mario, thanks.
Thank you, my friend.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll learn about a new real estate tool, and later, marking 20 years of a major album by a Tempe group with musician Roger Klein. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Opera presenting Falstaff. He's a glutton for punishment. Shakespeare's buffoon comes to life as the irascible and boastful Falstaff tries to seduce the wealthy wives of Windsor. Opens April 1st, azopera.org.
And you're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. Coming up later in the day, we begin our international news block on KJZZ, including a conversation about taxing sugar in Britain. It's the BBC NewsHour at 1, followed by The World at 2. And then national news discussion with All Things Considered on KJZZ begins at 3. In an area forecast today, today should feel much the same as yesterday. Expect clear skies with a high of 89 in the valley, mostly clear with a low around 58. Tomorrow, sunny with a high of 90. Expect a high of 90 for Friday and a slight increase for the weekend into the lower 90s and clear. Right now, it's 78 in the valley at 11:22.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Real estate has long been a huge part of the Valley economy and the Valley lifestyle, and no one expects that to change anytime soon. During the height of the housing boom, thousands of people quit their jobs to try to buy and sell homes, and many of us still head to Zillow or Trulia to check the estimated value of our homes. But how much of the information is accurate, and is there a better way? The Arizona Republic and AZ Central have determined there is, and it's called Street Scout. Reporter and columnist Catherine Rieger joins me to give us more details. Catherine, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for being with us. How long has Street Scout been in the works? I presume this was a long-term project.
It was. It's taken us about a year and a half. It's basically like a startup within our company, and we launched on Friday.
Okay, so when we think about this, as someone who talks to experts in this business, and you have for a long time, you write about it, what were some of the things that stood out to you as a journalist? Were there things that the average citizen might not have even been thinking about?
Yeah, well, and you know, what's great about Arizona and our real estate industry is so big and so important because of our growth. But we have some of the most accurate real estate data in the country. And so that gives us an advantage. Our comparable sales are cleaned up every day. Our partner on this is the Information Market, which is owned by Armless. And we've been working with them for 21 years doing Valley Home Values. And so that gives us a real advantage as a market. And we thought if we could make that data available to consumers, those comparable sales, and use this really accurate data we have to really provide an accurate home valuation tool, that would help a lot of people.
Is there a problem with inaccurate data? As I mentioned, some of us like to stream to some of those other websites just to find out, hey, are we doing well? Are we doing poorly? Whatnot. And a lot of those are estimates. So is Street Scout going to be better than that?
We are certainly striving, and right now our average valuation for Street Scout data valuations are within 5% of sales price. They have been working on this for years. We have great experts and advisors, and you know, other sites. You know, Mike Orr has said they eschew and has talked about problems with other valuations. And you know, really, the problem is when you have bad data evaluation, bad valuation, you can make bad decisions. You might think your house is worth more than it is and you decide to spend, or you may think you can't sell. And, you know, during the crash, the boom and the crash, I really saw this, and so many, as you said, so many homeowners and people saw this firsthand. So we are hoping that this helps.
Catherine, does this come down to the individual person or a couple when they're thinking about selling their home, that they should have more information? Is this the kind of information maybe a realtor should have and maybe a realtor already does have? Because I think when we think about looking at maybe comps in a neighborhood and that sort of thing, if you're not selling your home yourself, we have come to rely on experts. Is this just sort of an extra tool on top of that?
Yes, I mean, definitely. Real estate agents have the most precise valuations, and they have even more data and information. And I would never buy or sell a house without a real estate agent. They can tell you what a $50,000 kitchen upgrade does in your neighborhood and whether you're going to be able to sell for this. Absolutely, they have that. This is to get a ballpark. You know, since data is out there and valuations are already out there, we want to offer the most accurate. So if you're looking at trend lines and you're looking at comps, and there are people who just have no plan to buy or sell, but they like to check their valuation every few days. Makes it feel hopefully better than it did 5 years ago. And so it's fun. But we also provide neighborhood data, and we've used our great reporters and award-winning photographers to take photos and really look at neighborhoods, everything from real estate, but also things to do, best places to hike if you're in Anthem or if you're in Ahwatukee, crime data, also demographic data. So we're trying to couple that with information you can't get anywhere else.
How risky is it to check that information periodically? And I think about the stock market. People say, you know, if you're in the stock market for the long haul, don't check on a day when the market's way down. So, I mean, this must have been a rough patch for people when we were really in the downturn. And then when things were going crazy, it's like, oh, I want to check this every day. I mean, I'm being a little silly, but it is a little risky, isn't it, to the psyche?
Well, this is one thing about our valuation tool. It's called the Scouting Report. It will not change with one sale in your neighborhood, because that doesn't necessarily impact your valuation. Say your neighbor sells their house to their brother for half of what it's worth. On some valuation tools, you could see a dive in your valuation based on that. And we look at that and realize that it's not a normal sale. That isn't calculated as such. And so it won't change daily, you know, weekly. And it will be weighted based on how many sales you have, how many listings, how long it takes to sell, how many foreclosures you may have, how many flips in the market. Those are all taken into account. This model was built just for us and just for Metro Phoenix, and uses all those indicators to give you the most accurate.
Catherine, obviously I brought you on to talk about Street Scout. We have a couple of extra minutes. I wanted to ask you, are there certain trends you're seeing in general as far as the Valley housing market? We've been talking a lot about when are we going to return to normalcy. Based on some numbers Mike Orr has thrown out, it sounds like we sort of are, but are you seeing other signs of that?
You know, of course, this is prime buying season, which is great. Great weather, great time to be here, lots to do. That home prices are climbing. We're not back to, you know, peak home prices. The median price is about $235, and our peak was $267 in 2006. Some neighborhoods are, definitely. The part of the market that's maybe not doing as well as the other is the high-end market. There are a lot of listings for over $1 million, and that's kind of slowed down. And many people attribute that to the stock market. But right now, I am hearing we are seeing more of millennial buyers, which is we weren't sure if we would, but definitely homes for under $300,000 are selling much faster because it's hitting that group and what they can afford. So it's a good sign for home ownership in the Valley.
And finally, we also saw that trend for a while of a lot of out-of-state investors. What have you seen as far as signs go with that? Are we seeing more people who are actually buying a home to live in it or trying to flip it?
Very much to live in it. Those bargains from the foreclosure market, they're gone. You know that it's hard to find a great house to flip for, you know, affordable house to flip for a profit. Yes, definitely see more people buying to live in the house. We are not a big flip market anymore because our bargains are gone. But that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Arizona Republic and AZ Central reporter and columnist Catherine Rieger. We've been talking about the new real estate tool called Street Scout. Catherine, thanks.
Thank you very much, Steve.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Many analysts say fear has played a significant role in the current presidential campaign. Some voters are afraid of losing their jobs. Others have a fear of terrorism, primarily of the foreign variety. But terrorism expert Peter Bergen says domestic terrorism should actually be of greater concern. Bergen is the author of The United States of Jihad, Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists. He'll be in the Valley next Tuesday night as keynote speaker for the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations. Peter, where is the greatest terror threat on U.S. soil right now?
It comes from inside. The United States has hardened its defenses against foreign terrorist organizations. The last time there was a serious plot from outside was in 2010. Unluckily, it failed. A plot to blow up a SUV in Times Square in May of 2010. So what we're seeing is what we saw in San Bernardino, homegrown militants, what we saw in Fort Hood, Texas, what we saw at the Boston Marathon, you know, that's the threat. Unfortunately, these are almost invariably American citizens or American legal residents.
So what is the average American to make when we hear presidential candidates talk about making sure we have a border wall, making sure that we do more? Are they creating fear where they shouldn't be or where it really doesn't exist?
I think the short answer is they are creating fear where it doesn't exist. We looked at, for myself and my research team, looked at 300 cases since 9/11 of jihadist terrorism in the United States, some relatively trivial, some very serious. And we found that 4 out of 5 were committed by American citizens or legal permanent residents. All the lethal attacks have been conducted by American citizens or American permanent residents. And very few of these cases involve refugees or immigrants, proportionately to the much larger group of American citizens or residents who've done these kinds of crimes or attempted to do them.
Well, how does that relate to what we keep hearing, among a number of the presidential candidates related to whether we should allow in more Syrian refugees?
Well, I mean, if you're a refugee, if I was a terrorist, the last thing I'd do would be attempt to come into the United States as a refugee. First of all, you'd have to go from Syria to a refugee camp in Jordan. You'd have to be among the millions of people who did that. Then you'd have to be selected by the UN for a group of 23,000 who would then be offered to the United States as potential refugees, and then that number is whittled down further. And there's a 2-year process to go through before you can get into this country. And I mean, so there are easier ways to get in the United States than posing as a refugee. They are given absolutely the most amount of scrutiny possible. And we've also taken, as you've indicated in your question, I mean, only 2,000, which is, you know, a minuscule amount considering that you've got the largest refugee outflow since World War II coming out of Syria right now.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix talking with Peter Bergen. He's CNN's national security analyst, also the author of United States of Jihad. He'll also be the keynote speaker next week for the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations. Peter, I do want to ask you a little bit about part of this event has to do with China, which I do want to ask you one question, if you don't mind, in a moment. But what strikes me when we think about the San Bernardino situation, of course, many people are following closely the fight between Apple and the FBI. Is there reason to think that if Apple does, in fact, if they are compelled to do what the FBI would like, is there a reason to think that could give us information? Is there a reason to think that could prevent a future attack?
Well, we don't know. I mean, no one knows. Clearly a lot of information has already been gathered by the authorities from his phone records, from material that he kept on the cloud before he stopped backing up on the cloud with his iPhone. There was an extensive sweep of the house. There was also an extensive interrogation of the accomplice who sold him, gave him the weapons. There may be other stuff on the phone. I mean, the interesting thing about this dispute is both sides are right. The question is, who is more right? And that question is going to be decided by the Supreme Court at this point because, it's not like one side is completely right and the other side is completely wrong. It's a much more subtle case than that. And, the fact that the United States has got, almost unprecedented low unemployment rates at the moment is something to do in part with the tech economy, which is such an important part of the economy. Apple and Google are the two most valuable companies in the world. And a key part of their business model is the idea that their products are going to be safe and that you can use it without fear that somebody will be able to intercept your communications. Because the tech company's point is that, if you put a backdoor into something, backdoor so-called, no longer encrypted. It's not just the U.S. government who can get in, but other people. So we'll see how this plays out.
How vital do you think that ultimate Supreme Court decision is as it relates to whether the FBI or the NSA actually think they are making progress on preventing attacks? Do you think that if, in fact, they were to win the case, then they could argue with a fact-based argument that they can, in fact, this more information could, in fact, help prevent future attacks?
Well, one way to answer that is how do attacks actually get stopped? And, many of them are through very traditional forms of law enforcement. Suspicious activity reports, family members dropping a dime or community members, informants, undercover officers. I mean, there's a whole panoply of things that the United States government can do when they're investigating a case. So the idea that, preventing terrorism will rise and fall on the issue of encryption, I think that simply is not borne out by the facts.
Now, you've written quite a bit in the book, of course, about American jihadists. What do these American jihadists have in common? Are they folks who, for the most part, seem to have developed into an average American life? And are people ultimately surprised when they have taken this step?
Sure. I mean, think the San Bernardino couple were, in fact, almost a perfect mirror of the average American involved in these kinds of cases that we, and myself and my research team, looked at 300 cases since 9/11 of Americans involved in this, and we found that the average age was 29, a third were married, a third had kids, they were about as educated as the average Americans, similar average incomes, they were not career criminals, the incidence of serious mental illness were actually below the general population. So that's all a long way of saying these were ordinary Americans, these are ordinary Americans, and it's a puzzle why people who appear to be living the American dream would, take up arms against their fellow citizens and shoot completely innocent strangers, essentially.
Do you anticipate this sort of threat is going to be with us for the long haul?
I do. I think it's a persistent low-level threat, but one we shouldn't sort of, paint as existential or, suggest that we should ban all Muslim immigration and, take extreme measures of any kind, because it's a persistent low-level threat that has been largely managed and contained. If we'd had this discussion in 2002, and then we predicted that a decade and a half after 9/11, 45 Americans would be killed by jihadi terrorists in this country, that would have seemed like an absurdly optimistic prediction, but that is actually what has happened. And of course, each of those deaths as an individual is a tragedy, but they're not national catastrophes on the scale of 9/11, or even of what we saw in Paris in November of last year, where 130 people were killed in an ISIS-directed and trained attack.
How dangerous is ISIS now compared to what Al-Qaeda was before 9/11?
They're different. I mean, Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda succeeded on 9/11. I mean, let me give you this very interesting statistic. On 9/11, there were 16 people on the no-fly list. There are 47,000 today. I mean, none of those hijackers would have gotten on an American plane because they would have been on the no-fly list. And there are 1.5 million people on a much larger list of people who would be put into secondary screening because they're deemed to have some even very tangential relationship to terrorism. So, ISIS is certainly, controls more territory, controls millions of people, and in that sense is more dangerous than Al-Qaeda. And yet, on the other hand, we've hardened our defenses in the United States. So whether it's ISIS or Al-Qaeda, it's extremely hard for a foreign terrorist organization to launch a mass casualty attack in the United States, as we saw in Paris or last year, or of course, 9/11. So, the question of, ISIS is in many ways more successful than Al-Qaeda, but Al-Qaeda, after all, was a group that killed 3,000 Americans on a Tuesday morning on September 11th, 2001. The notion that ISIS could do something like that, I think, is extraordinarily unlikely.
And finally, the U.S. has very complicated relationships with Russia and China at this point, but these are obviously major powers in the world, at least Russia redeveloping into a major power. Though one wouldn't think that there would be a state-led terrorism effort. Certainly not. Are those two countries, whether it's cyber terrorism or other aspects of terrorism, that the U.S. And U.S. citizens need to keep a close eye on?
Well, China is constantly doing cyber espionage attacks against the United States, and I think that's just going to continue. would they launch an attack that rose to an attack that did serious financial damage to the United States or created some kind of mess? I think the answer is that's highly unlikely because, they're highly dependent on the internet as we are. And after all, we owe them a lot of money. And typically, a banker doesn't kill its major, the person that the bank has loaned the most amount of money to. So, that's a long way of saying that while the Chinese are constantly launching operations against us to steal our secrets, they're going to keep it at about that level because it wouldn't make sense to do something that rose to something that we would have to respond to in a way that would create some kind of war between us.
Peter Bergen is CNN's national security analyst, the vice president at New America. He's the author of the book, The United States of Jihad. He'll be in the Valley next week as the keynote speaker for the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations. Peter, thank you for squeezing us in. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Dave.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll meet novelist Diana Taylor Hart. And we'll also mark 20 years of a major album by a Tempe group with musician Roger Klein. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by ASU Morrison Institute for Public Policy, Arizona's think tank for research, analysis, and public outreach, addressing the state's key challenges and opportunities. Learn more at morrisoninstitute.asu.edu.
And in the next hour of Here and Now on KJZZ, more discussion on President Obama's Supreme Court nomination, Merrick Garland, his background in philosophy, plus a conversation about the Hispanic vote in the presidential race after Senator Marco Rubio lost his home state in the Florida primary election last night. Stay with KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by Citizens Clean Elections Commission. The Arizona presidential preference election informs political parties of voters' favored presidential candidates, what to bring to the polls, and more at azcleanelections.gov/PPE.
We're still looking for an expected high of 89 in the valley today in clearer skies. Tonight, a low around 58. Tomorrow, sunny with a high of 90. Right now, it's 78 and partly cloudy at 11:41.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. In recent years, Arizona has more frequently become the setting for mysteries or crime-related fiction. But author Diana Taylor Hart has taken that a step further. The third book in her Old Pueblo series was published earlier this year. It focuses on 28-year-old Samantha Ryan, a principal at Madison Elementary School in the Barrio in Tucson. Diana Taylor Hart will be at Changing Hands Bookstore in Tempe on Saturday night at 7. And she joins me now. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you very much for giving me this opportunity.
So tell us a little bit about your background as a teacher. Did you actually teach in the Barrios of Tucson?
Oh, absolutely. I did. I taught in several barrios, and that was really a lot of fun. I taught from pre-K all the way to sixth grade. And it was a wonderful experience. The kids were great. And the parents, you know, when they first got to meet me, they didn't know exactly what to do with me because I was very young at that point. And once they figured out that I was there for their children, and they really came over and they came into the classroom. I got them there. I would call them every day if they didn't come to see us. And it was a lot of fun teaching with them. And it's not just teaching the kids, but the parents about how to deal with their kids and also how to develop their full potential.
How important was the melding of cultures there?
You know, it was a wonderful time. In that time period, we had kids that were from different nationalities, and it was fun because they came and they really were interested in learning, and the parents were too. The parents started to come into the classrooms more and more because they wanted to learn how I was teaching their children how to read, or if I was teaching math or social studies. It was very interesting. We did a lot of stuff writing plays and performing them for the other classrooms. And we just had a great time.
Well, you obviously did because you decided to make that the setting of your series of Old Pueblo books. I always have to ask novelists this with the protagonist. How much do you have in common with Samantha?
Some. I think everybody, it has that issue. But that is also every character is part of you. And those characters are either really good people, and then you have the villains. And you think, oh, my God, how do you get those? And it's just part of the job. And writing really meant a lot to me. It became a passion. And I have seen and heard on radio and on television and on the Internet that children and adults have been victimized. And one of the things that I really wanted to do is to make them have a voice. And so I started the Old Pueblo series doing that. The main character is Samantha. She is better known as Sam. She is feisty. She is, and yet she's a bit fragile. She lost her parents at 17 and her 5-year-old daughter with leukemia. And she was pretty upset and had withdrawn a little bit. But when she became the elementary school principal in the barrio, in Moving On, she really loved teaching. And one of the things that the teachers didn't want to do is have a principal walking into your classroom and teaching with them. And Sam really did her best to get everybody to change it, well, to get everybody there and to change the culture. On her first day on the job, she walks into her office and she finds this horrific scene. From that moment on, the mystery begins, and it goes on to going home, which it continues. And Sam is 28 years old now in this book, and she is summoned to her grandparents' estate. And after a really vicious confrontation with them, she receives an urgent message from the school regarding a withdrawn 5-year-old little girl. Sam absolutely was very upset and wanted to know the answers. Mm-hmm. And she began to wonder what happened to their mothers. Now, why is the father having custody of their two daughters? And she was very concerned when she met the father. He was abusive, and he was an alcoholic.
Let me jump in, Diana, because I want to say that we don't want to give away too much. We don't have much time left. I want to say, since this is your third book in the series now, what has changed for you about, do you feel more attached to Sam, the character? Do you feel like you're writing it even better?
I think so. I actually do. In Finding Justice, she is amazing. She is in court testifying against a villain. And then she is hoping to adopt two young girls. And she was stunned when she left the courtroom. And she found out that her cousin, Sarah, was trying to stop the adoption. So I will tell you, the mystery continues from there on.
Diana Taylor Hart is a novelist. The third book in her Old Pueblo series was published earlier this year. It focuses on 28-year-old Samantha Ryan, a principal at Madison Elementary School in the Barrio in Tucson. If you want to learn more about the Old Pueblo series or meet Diana Taylor Hart, she'll be at Changing Hands Bookstore in Tempe this Saturday night at 7. Diana, great to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. 20 years ago, a lot of the music scene and the airwaves were dominated by grunge. Bands like Nirvana and Pearl Jam, Soundgarden and Stone Temple Pilots. And it didn't seem like there was much room for other kinds of rock. That was the environment when Roger Klein and his bandmates from the Tempe-based Refreshments started getting approached by record labels that wanted to sign them. And ultimately, Mercury Records released Fizzy Fuzzy Big and Buzzy, putting the Refreshments on tour and on the radio. Klein has marked the 20th anniversary of the album by playing it in its entirety, solo and acoustic, and he's with me now to talk about how it all got started. Roger, you've described the Refreshments as a Tempe bar band, but were you ready to make the leap to a label and have your music recognized nationally potentially, or was there an intimidation factor?
It was a very exciting prospect to be signed by a major label, because back in the day, unsigned bands were somehow not making the cut, right? That was a stigma. So to become a signed band was a validation of sorts. I mean, but at the time, you know, I was a younger man and the atmosphere was different. The environment was different. To be signed by a major label gave you a lot of potential to have your art and commerce delivered to the public in a way that there was just no way to do otherwise.
Did you think you were ready to make the big leap at that point?
The fact is, I didn't know. I honestly did not know. I didn't know if what I was writing would be received well beyond the club scene in Tempe or, you know, every once in a while here in Prescott, Tucson, Flagstaff, etc. It wasn't until we garnered attention of Mercury Records and other record labels, too, And South by Southwest, that festival invited us to a very, very good slot. And ASCAP gave us a showcase that I started to feel an internal validation, whereas before I had questions. You know, as a young man, as a writer, I was like, I don't know if this is good enough. I would listen to other people's things, including people locally, like the Gin Blossoms, who are contemporaries of ours, going, I think I've got what it takes. I think we've got the sound, the song, the pop sensibility. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't sure. So it was, you know, as much as I'd like to look back and say I was totally confident, I wasn't.
Now, you guys had done a little bit of recording in the Valley, but a much bigger step up to go to L.A. Were you thinking, this is awesome? You're thinking, this is kind of daunting.
Yeah, it was awesome. And the record company, Mercury at the time, this was kind of an unheard of story. When they sat us down and basically wined and dined us, and that was in Austin, their A&R person, Peter Lubin, led with, we don't want to change anything. I've seen you play. You know what you're doing. We feel it's working. You're going to be a heritage rock band as long as we don't interfere and get in your way, which was unheard of. They didn't say, you know, we want to cut your hair or frost your videos or whatever it would be or make you write with other people and just keep doing what you're doing. And then they walked their talk by saying, listen to the record you love, what producer, and then look at the producer credits and tell us whom you want to interview. And so we did. We took interviews with several people, and then we met Cliff Norell, who said basically the same thing as Mercury. I've seen you guys play live. All I want to do is capture that lightning in a bottle, and that's what we're going to try to do.
So with Fizzy Fuzzy, Big and Buzzy, when people have heard it, I think back to, again, 95, 96, being at the gym, whatever it may be, and you're hearing alt-rock, and you're hearing Bandidos all over the place. Mm-hmm. Now, was that luck of the draw that Bandidos was the single? Do you think things would have worked out as well if you picked another single?
No, and we had the opportunity to. Once again, Mercury gave us a lot of creative freedom, and including which songs we would put on the album, how we would sequence them, and which song we wanted. They were going to give us a single, which they did. They gave us two. Actually, they gave us four, but we got cut short at two. And they asked us to choose the singles. Unheard of, you know, dream come true. Anyway, we flipped a coin between Bandidos and Blue Collar Suicide, and it came up Bandidos, and I'm really glad it did. Otherwise, we might not be having this conversation.
Well, even the lyrics of that song, they're clever, they're different. I mean, the thing that always comes back to me is the Jean-Luc Picard one, which is, of course, with the Star Trek show of the 90s.
Sure, that was very timely.
Yeah, but I mean, how did you make it all work? Because I hear it today, and I still think, okay, maybe some of the lyrics sound dated, but they still sound fun and creative.
I was just living a fantasy that pretty much a lot of people my age probably still live. You know, I was a starving artist and starving college student. Put the two together, you know, trying to focus on one career or another, determine which was going to be my life way. Basically, out of money, you know, living with too many people in squalor, well, in American squalor, right. And fantasizing, like, I could knock over a Circle K and make $465 work really for a long time in Mexico. And the Jean-Luc Picard reference just came kind of as an echo, as a rhyme echo for give your ID card to the border guard. And, you know, it was just there. It was an availability heuristic. I'd been watching Star Trek The Next Generation. It just kind of came out, made it, and it was catchy enough to catch people's ears and make the cut.
Is there another song that doesn't get talked about a lot from that album that you think that you wish did? Like even when you went out and played the solo acoustic, which we'll talk about as well.
I think my best musical and lyrical work, and it includes like the band's sort of their best creative work and where we gelled the most, was on a song called Mekong. And it still carries a lot of water in my career. You know, it's been adopted by the Peacemakers as a theme song too. It works seamlessly between both bands, between Refreshments and Roger Klein and the Peacemakers, in that it just says, you know, as cliche as it may sound, I'd like to raise another round. If your bottle's empty, help yourself to mine. Thank you for your time. Here's to life.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix talking with Roger Klein. We're talking about the 20th anniversary of Fizzy Fuzzy Big and Buzzy, the album he made with The Refreshments. He, of course, is with The Peacemakers as well, and they've got a gig coming up April the 2nd at Talking Stick Resort. Roger, let's talk about you playing this album again all by yourself. So how'd that idea come about? How did it feel?
The idea came about because New Year's Eve of last year, we played at the Marquee Theater, and we ended up being lax in booking the opening bands. I didn't realize it was the onus was on us, that we got to pick the opening bands. I thought that the club did. So with some degree of frustration, the club contacted us and said, hey, how about we get these bands in the paper, spur some ticket sales, and get this thing sold out? And I was of the opinion that it was their job, and they said no. So what are you going to do? I contacted some bands that I know and I love, but they're all booked. This is pretty last minute, within about 2 or 3 weeks of New Year's Eve. So somebody said, well, Fizzy Fuzzy's going to be 20 years old. Why don't you guys play that? And the band had a discussion about it, and we thought that it would be sort of the band goes on and then the band goes on, a little superfluous for the show. Mm-hmm. Somebody suggested I do it. I agreed before thinking it over very much. And then after I agreed, I realized, wow, that makes me really nervous because I hadn't gone back and listened to the record in some time. It was really fun, but I was very, very nervous.
Was that good stress or was it bad stress?
It was good stress. It was very good stress. I still get butterflies before I go on stage. The hardest part about my day, if I'm performing, is the last 10 minutes. I get super fidgety, and that time I'm just trying not to have a panic attack. You know, just remember what I got to do, have fun, relax. But when you're thinking all that, you're getting in your own way. But I'm very glad that I still do have that anxiety, that nervousness, or else I think I would be somehow careless.
So now 20 years on from Fizzy Fuzzy, sure feels like you have settled in, you're comfortable with it, you love it. Did you have, even with the career you've had, did you have bumps along the way going, will people stop asking me to play that?
I've been lucky. No, I don't feel that way. I know that I've been in two bands that have been pretty, very, very bit public. But from my point of view, it's one career. Mm-hmm. It's myself who's making this music I've been fortunate to make it with different musicians, lots of different musicians and a couple different band names. I would worry if people stopped asking for those songs. There have been, honestly, some times where I've been tempted to omit songs, but I've tried sometimes to give Mekong a rest so that I can hear it, you know, or I've tried to leave Bandidos off the set list, and invariably it's going to get yelled out at you if you're fortunate enough to have an encore, so we make good on that.
So how has this affected the music you're going to make going forward by yourself with the Peacemakers? Has it changed anything about your vision, the reception that the 20th anniversary of Fizzy Fuzzy has gotten?
That's a really good question. No, I haven't thought about that. Maybe a little bit. I'm in the midst of writing right now. I'm always writing. How has the reception of Fizzy Fuzzy affected my vision? In my writing right now, I'm just writing spontaneously. I'm not writing towards an ethos, a telos, a statement of purpose, which is usual for me. I usually do. But right now I'm just seeing what happens. And I'm sure that the positive reception so far that Fizzy Fuzzy has had will have an influence on that. Trying to dig a little deeper. I look at my habits as a songwriter and a musician. I have a lot of them. I look back at Fizzy Fuzzy and I see those habits forming. But they're innocent and they're accidental, and I'm trying to find that place again.
Yeah, Roger Klein, we've been talking about the 20th anniversary of Fizzy Fuzzy Big and Buzzy, which he did with The Refreshments. Of course, you know him from The Peacemakers as well. And he'll be playing in the Valley with The Peacemakers on April the 2nd at Talking Stick Resort in Scottsdale. Roger, thanks for coming in.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And that's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks to Bruce Drummond and Jimmy Jenkins for their assistance on the program. And thank you very much for listening. If you want to hear my conversations with Peter Bergen about terrorism, Catherine Rieger about real estate, or musician Roger Klein, or one of our previous programs, please go online to KJZZ.org later this afternoon. Or you can download the free KJZZ app to your smartphone. This is member-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great afternoon.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore Chandler, celebrating the Subaru Love Spring event, offering the new 2016 Subaru Legacy, the 36 mpg midsize sedan redefined. Ready now for test drives? Shop Subaru.com.